Pretty Late with Patty Vasquez. Matt Bubala filling in for Patty. She'll be back on Monday night, as always. Okay, bear with me here. In the New York Times article I was reading, it says, the last waltz of a pair of black holes shockingly larger than astrophysicists had been expecting. One of them was 36 times as massive as the sun, the other 29. Think about how big that is. As they approached the end at half the speed of light, they were circling each other 250 times a second. Stop and pull that together, okay? We've got a star. No, we have a pair of black holes. One black hole is 36 times as massive as our sun. The other is 29 times as massive as our sun. At the end, they are spinning around each other 250 times a second.
And it takes us 365 days to rotate once around our sun.
Do you want to hear what it sounds like when they collide?
Well, let's hold on for a second. Right. And then the ringing stopped as the two holes coalesced into a single black hole, a trapdoor in space with the equivalent mass of 62 suns, all in a fifth of a second Earth time. Dr. Weiss said you could reproduce the chirp by running your fingernails across the keys of a piano from the low end to middle C. Let's hear it, Craig. Lost in the transformation was three solar masses worth of energy, vaporized into gravitational waves in an unseen and barely felt apocalypse. As visible light, that energy would be equivalent to the brightness of a billion trillion suns. Now, to explain all that, as if he was telling you how to tie your shoes, is my friend Dr. Jason Steffen from the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Hello, Dr. Steffen. How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Dude, I can't make heads or tails of this. I mean, just the sentence, two black holes, one 36 times as massive as our sun, one 29 times, we're circling each other 250 times a second.
It's pretty great, isn't it?
Oh, man. How do you guys figure that stuff out? And how do we know it's even true? You could tell me anything and I'd have to believe it.
Well, people have been scientists have been modeling the in-spiral of these kinds of binary systems, like black hole systems, or black hole neutron star systems, for about 20 years or so, in anticipation of being able to detect them with this instrument.
So these scientists, so we're going to talk about gravitational waves. This was proposed by Einstein first back in 1918, something like that, right? But scientists have literally been chasing these waves in earnest for like 40 years, right, at least?
Yeah, the current instruments aren't quite that old, but there were some previous instruments that have been around for about that long, yes.
I mean, two of the scientists on this project first met in 1975, and when they first met, it says they stayed up all night talking about how to test general relativity and debating how best to search for gravitational waves. So the ideas and the fascination has been around for a very long time, and it comes and goes in popularity, but they built this system to detect gravitational waves. Can you explain for me, Jason, so that I, somebody who would not win on Are You Smarter Than a Fifth Grader, could understand what a gravitational wave is?
Yeah, gravitational wave. So everything in the universe is kind of floating around in space, but the presence of those objects distorts the space around it. Imagine having like a rubber sheet or a trampoline or something like that, and you put a big bowling ball on it. It's going to distort the shape of the trampoline surface.
Okay.
And so if you had two bowling balls that are orbiting around each other, you would see ripples in the trampoline surface based upon, you know, how fast the bowling balls were moving and so forth. That's the gravitational radiation or gravity waves.
Now,
so it's the distortion of space-time that is propagating outwards because there's two massive objects that are sloshing around.
I guess what I can't understand, I can understand that the picture you just painted in my head, I've got this huge like maybe bedroom sheet that's all stretched out, and now there's two bowling balls on it, so they're changing the shape of the sheet, and now they're circling each other, and so they're creating waves that ripple out through the rest of the sheet. This LIGO system, these antennas that they set up to capture this, I believe it said, so all that power that I just read about happening and circling around each other and then happening, only like made the tiniest of little waves on their instruments, because I'm guessing we're billions of light years away, because, you know, when I skip a rock on the shore, there's a bigger wave and a smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller as it goes. Is that why we're detecting a tiny little wave from something that was so massively powerful?
That's part of it. So part of it is that we are a long ways away from it. The other part is that space itself, the thing that's being distorted, is very, very stiff. So it's not, the idea of a trampoline is probably a little disingenuous. It's more like a sheet of stainless steel with two balls rolling around it and causing small distortions. Space is really stiff, and so it takes a lot to cause a distortion in it.
Now, when we say, so you paint the picture by giving us this sheet or this piece of stainless steel, but I don't understand that analogy in a way, because space is space. It's everywhere. It's all encompassing. These things aren't really laying on anything. And like, even though these two things were laying on that sheet, there could be things underneath it and things above it. So is that sheet just wherever any objects are? You have to imagine the sheet underneath it and the ripples that are being caused?
Yeah, whenever there's something that exists out there, it distorts the region around it so that straight lines aren't really straight anymore. If you shine a flashlight near an object like the sun, for example, the first time that general relativity was tested was looking at stars that should have been behind the sun and therefore not visible, but that were in fact made visible because the light was being bent around the sun, because space was being distorted around the sun. So they waited for an eclipse to happen. When the moon got in front of the sun, it allowed some of the stars to be visible in the background. And those stars, their positions were known before the eclipse, and their positions were known to also, they should have been directly behind the sun. The fact that they could see them was an indication that the space around the sun was being distorted because of the sun's mass.
This is a very interesting conversation you're having. As just kind of an aside, as we try to digest what you're saying, how accurate is Flash? We were discussing that earlier.
God. You're jumping to Flash TV now?
Show. No, no, it's fine. You can keep going with your questioning, Matt. You're both very
intelligent. Real quick, Jason, we're all wondering if, because you're not able to handle all this talk,
yeah,
if we just watch The Flash and they've got these alternate universes, are we comprehending that? Or is that,
that's
the TV and the movie,
right,
you've seen make no sense at all compared to the reality of the science?
Typically, when television shows and movies portray general relativity and distortions of space-time, they don't normally get it right, unfortunately.
So in The Flash, he can go into a whole thingy and then pop out in a different universe or a different time. That's the
Wouldn't
entire
that be cool?
explanation.
All right, we're going to come back to that, because as silly as that sounds, we do need you to explain whether or not time travel is possible. And I still don't quite understand, like, to me, when we're talking about the sun, the space and time is shifting and changing, to me that's just light. So is that a difference than actually shifting time and space? And now that gravitational waves have been accepted and proven to really exist, does that mean that some sort of time travel, or maybe a quicker way to get across space, is possible? We'll ask Jason that next on 720 WGN. Solving all the problems of the universe with Dr. Jason Steffen from the Kepler program and from UNLV. This has nothing to do with Kepler. You guys weren't involved in this at all, right, Jason?
No, we weren't.
Are you disappointed in
that? It would have been great, though.
It would have been great, but it sounds like a lot of work. Okay, so let's jump to this. Because we'd need like a podcast of about 40 straight hours, I think, to really delve into this. I'm guessing we could talk about this for that long, but we only have a few minutes left. So let's jump to this. Part of the idea is that in the whole time travel relates to the proof of this, correct? The theory of time travel?
You know, that's a bit outside my expertise. I'm not, I think a lot of people like to talk about time travel as you go in, you walk into one black hole and you pop out of another, but it's pretty speculative.
Well, tell me about the bending of space and time. What does that exactly mean?
So what it means is in the universe, you define a straight line by the path that light would take. And if you put some massive object out there, like any object with mass, the gravity of that object is going to cause light to bend slightly around it. And since you define a straight line by the path that light would take, you basically would be distorting what, you know, what a grid would look like. You place something on it, it distorts the shape of the grid because it distorts the path that light would take going around it.
Can we picture this at all?
Company?
I don't know.
I get it.
Stop it, Roger.
I do.
I'm thinking about when I drive my car. If there was a road that went straight from here to, say, the Soviet Union, and I got on and I started driving, to me, it would seem like it was an exact straight line. But in reality, it would be curved, right? Because it would be curving around the Earth.
Right.
Is that related
and
to this
so the same kind of thing happens. It's really that the coordinates that you use to measure things are different. And light always travels the shortest distance between two points. And in the case of when you have some object that's there, the shortest distance or the fastest distance between the two points is going to be on a curved path. Part of that is when the light approaches an object, it changes... it changes its frequency. It basically is falling into the gravity, and that alters the properties of the photons, or alters the property of light. This is something that the GPS satellites need to correct for when they're dealing with, you know, locating something on the Earth, is it needs to correct for the fact that the signals that it's sending is being distorted by the Earth's gravity.
Doesn't, if I may ask, when it comes into the range of a stronger source and it's curving, that source is causing it to curve around, does it not then speed up that light? Does the light not travel faster as it kind of whips around the curve?
So the light doesn't travel faster. What happens is distance changes. What you mean by distance changes. And so light always travels at a fixed distance in a fixed amount of time. The speed of light is always a constant. No matter how fast you try to move, if you're going close to the speed of light and you throw a baseball in front of you, the speed of light, even to that baseball, is always the same speed.
So
one of the kind of strange things about Einstein's theories, especially of special relativity, is it actually means that velocity doesn't add the way that you think that it should, and length and time are related to each other in ways that weren't really expected until he came along.
Mm. All right, so let me try to do this one more time and see if I can understand this. So if we're saying the light is always traveling the same speed, but because of gravitational waves, maybe the distance changes. So is it like because of the ripples of gravitational waves, maybe something gets hit by one of those ripples and it moves? So it's actually closer to another object than it's normally supposed to be.
That's basically what happens in these antennas that were built, is you have two arms that are filled with light. They have, they're called Fabry-Perot cavities. They're cavities of light where you send light in and it just bounces around a whole bunch of times. And when the gravity wave passes through, it will change the length of one arm with respect to the other arm. And you can see that change in arm length in the instrument. Like it basically, the light comes back out, it shines it on this little camera, and when one arm length changes to another, it changes the brightness of the spot that comes out.
So these...
And so when the gravity wave comes through, it actually is physically distorting the shape of this antenna. It has two perpendicular arms. One arm will shrink, the other arm will lengthen. And that's how you can detect the signal going through.
So this gravitational wave actually moved one arm one way and one arm another way?
It changed
the tiniest
properties of space-time between the two ends of the arm. It didn't like go down there and physically push on it.
Okay.
The space between them constricted or expanded.
So the objects themselves did not change in any way, but the space did. So,
right.
Wow, dude, that's tough to grasp.
Can I imagine them being attached to a rubber band or something like that, and that rubber band is stretching and compressing just slightly as the wave goes through. But the amount of rubber band between them is still the same. It's just being stretched and compressed.
But these arms weren't being stretched or compressed. Or are they actually the arms of the LIGO, were they sort of to like just a proton change being stretched or compressed? Or the actual
they were
physically there.
So the wave comes through and it stretches one and compresses the other as the wave passes through. I mean, they wiggle one arm when one arm compresses, the other one expands, and when the other arm compresses, the first one expands as the wave passes through. And it's the amount that it stretches or compresses is tiny. It's a tiny fraction of the width of a proton. An incredibly small distance that the arm length changes.
How do they?
It's still something that you can detect.
How do they set them up, Jason, so that they're not affected by anything else, like a rumbling in the earth or anything else that could happen? I mean, when it's such a fine measurement, how do they make sure that it's not reading anything else at all?
That's been the main technology driver for the whole system. And that's why it's taken them 20 years to get this thing up and running to the point where it is now, is that at each stage of the development, they've said, okay, we can see the waves crashing from the beaches. You know, we can see the ocean waves crashing on the beaches a couple hundred miles away. We can see the moose walking by. We can see the drunk person that crashes their car into the tunnel where the thing is. All of these environmental effects they can see in the detector, and they have to know how to do two things. One of them is correct for them. Like, they can see all the AM radio stations in their electronics. So they have to be able to identify things that they can't get rid of and just not analyze that part of the data. They also have to be able to isolate their mirrors that are where the light is stored from the seismic vibrations of the system. And so the seismic isolation system is this gigantic contraption that's carefully designed so that any of this rumbling, low-frequency rumbling that the Earth has is damped away and doesn't affect the motion of those mirrors.
It's fascinating. It's just fascinating, Jason. I wish I could wrap my head around it better. But one last thing. I mentioned this earlier. Somebody had written on social media today to think about when Einstein came up with all of this, the era that he lived in without all the electronics and everything else that we have now. Is it amazing to you to think about this is something this man with a piece of chalk and a blackboard was able to, you know, think about and come up with these theories?
It is pretty impressive, the kinds of stuff that you can do just by thinking about it and writing down what the model is and making predictions from there. It's amazing how fruitful the human mind is and how clever they can be when need arises.
Yeah.
You know, if computing time or computer processor time was much more valuable than it actually is today, Microsoft Word might load a lot faster on your computer than it does now. I mean, things would run a lot more efficiently if it was as valuable as it was, if computer time was as valuable now as it was when computers were first invented in the, you know, 60s and 70s. I downloaded one presentation today that was larger than every video game that I ever played all the way through the 1980s combined.
Well, enjoy sitting through that presentation this weekend, then. I hope it's a good one. Jason, I love talking to you. I love trying to figure this stuff out, and I'm sorry I don't have a better brain to do it, but I appreciate you trying to get us through it, and good luck out there at UNLV. We'll talk to you again soon, okay?
Okay, sounds good.
All right, Jason. Thank you so much. Jason Steffen from the